again. My name is Julia Koprek. I work with an organization called the Food Trust. I have nothing to disclose. We are based out of Philadelphia, but we work nationally on expanding healthy food access and nutrition education. So as our executive director, Yael Lehman, explained in the video just now, we really believe in this comprehensive approach on working with farmers markets, in corner stores, with grocery store owners, and with educators to really increase access and increase people being able to eat better. But some of the work that I'm going to talk about today is around specifically how to incentivize getting grocery stores into underserved neighborhoods or what people call food deserts. And, you know, I probably don't need to tell you that fresh food access is at the forefront of public health and looking into, you know, what factors affect obesity and diet-related disease. And, you know, while supermarkets are not a magic bullet, they are part of a comprehensive approach. Certainly, if we are telling people that they need to eat healthier, we need to be providing places for them to shop. And the theme of this year's annual meeting is healthography and looking at the built environment. And certainly a key factor in where you live is what you have access to buy. And if what you only have access to buy is unhealthy food, then you're more unlikely to have a better diet and lead a healthier life as a result. You know, there's a lot of data out there, not only on consumption, but really on specific health outcomes as well. And if you are not familiar with a report that the Food Trust did with a group called Policy Link, it's called Access to Healthy Food and Why It Matters, and it's available on the Food Trust website. It's all of the research that's been done over the last several decades around food access, health, income, and a great resource to go to. So when you talk to grocers, and I talk to a lot of grocers in my line of work, the conversation always comes back to when you're talking about food deserts and grocery stores, you know, the startup costs and the cost of development and what's required by a grocery store owner to undertake in order to open or expand an existing grocery store. And the Pennsylvania Fresh Food Financing Initiative was the first program of its kind to partner with grocers and provide specific flexible financing in the form of grants and loans to expand or open new grocery stores. And, you know, the impacts of that program are listed here. But this was, you know, really a way to bring together health and economic development and engage the grocery industry on solving this problem of food deserts. Now, this was a program that was run across the state of Pennsylvania. It was launched in 2004. There were 88 projects total approved for funding, and it was a variety of projects across, you know, both in Philadelphia and a lot of rural parts of Pennsylvania, small stores, large supermarkets, farmers markets. It was really a variety of projects that were part of this initiative. And as a result, you know, this the initiative was seen around the country as a potential model to expand and replicate. But the way it's worked, both in Pennsylvania and other places that have replicated this model, is, you know, there's some seed funding that comes from either government or a philanthropic institution that then goes to fund managers. So it really functions as a public-private partnership. The Food Trust has worked a lot with CDFIs, Community Development Financial Institutions, that have a lot of experience lending in low-income communities. This is really their charge by the U.S. Treasury. And they've been key implementers in healthy food financing. And ultimately, the funds do go to projects that go into underserved communities. So to rewind back a little bit to 2008, you know, after seeing the success in Pennsylvania, other places around the country were exploring, hey, is this something that we can do in our cities, our states as well? Philadelphia isn't the only place that has underserved communities that don't have grocery stores. And so along with partners from Tulane PRC, the Food Trust came together and helped to convene a food policy advisory committee. And this was a multi-sector group with one of the first times that a lot of these people came to the table together, grocery store owners with people from, you know, the health sector, the financial sector, to talk about this issue in New Orleans post-Katrina, and to see could we replicate the model that was started in Pennsylvania. Well, I'll skip ahead to 2011. The actual process took quite a bit of time to actually get the funding appropriated and the program launched, but I'll speed ahead. That's a topic of actually another paper that Tulane put out, so if you're interested in that, you can certainly read more about that process of getting through the policy. But I want to talk a little bit about, this is the launch of the program, our executive director, Yael Lehman, at the mayor's office back in 2011. I want to talk about this initiative as, you know, a place-based initiative and a public-private partnership, and also talk through the challenges of a program that specifically relies on engagement by an outside group in order to make the program a success. So just by the program in and of itself, you know, trying to have some achievements isn't enough. You need to have the engagement of the grocery industry and other outside partners. But just, you know, the basics of the program, it was seeded with the city's allocation of disaster relief CDBG dollars. All types of projects are eligible, so it could be a supermarket or a co-op or a small corner store that could apply for funds. And the funds can be used for anything from land acquisition to construction to workforce development. So it's really designed, you know, if somebody's going to open a new store or expand a store in an area of need, that any types of resources that are needed to get them up and running are available. And a key part of the program are the flexible dollars. So part of the New Orleans program is a component of forgivable debt. In some places it's been grants. In New Orleans here we have forgivable debt. And that can really help incentivize, make that push for a project to actually come to fruition, you know, and get the all of the financing needed to be able to open. And we partner here. The Food Trust helps to implement the program along with HOPE, which is a CDFI that has offices here in New Orleans. So one of the roles that the Food Trust plays, both in New Orleans and other places, is we review applications. We want to be good stewards of public funds and make sure that the dollars are being allocated to areas that are truly in need. We don't want to be opening a store in an affluent community that already has three grocery stores, and we want to be functioning within the market and not providing, oversaturating a market. You know, we're really trying to put supermarkets where they don't exist currently or where it's not sufficient enough for the residents in that community. So we look at income, and also we look at an underserved criteria. And lastly, we look at community fit, which is really a qualitative assessment of every project to think about size, offerings, price point, capacity of the operator, engagement of local food systems, and a set of other criteria that we compile together to assess whether people would be eligible for a program. This is a study that was published in the Journal of Public Health Management and Practice recently. You know, there are some programs out there like the New Markets Tax Credits Program or others where you're in or you're out. So you look at an address, you type it into a computer, and you're either yes, you are eligible, and no, you're not. And with, you know, healthy food financing and these types of place-based initiatives, it's a lot more nuanced than that. I know that Tulane has done some work in addition to the research that Adrian was talking about. They've done analysis of, on a store-by-store basis, what that store is offering. You know, so you might see a store, you know, that's called a supermarket, but they actually don't have any fresh produce. So, and, you know, in some of the mapping tools or data that's out there, how it gets classified, and then when you click an address into a tool, you know, we were getting questions at the Food Trust, like, wait, my neighborhood is not coming up as a food desert or other criteria that people were using. Am I no longer eligible? And, you know, these types of, you know, neighborhoods are changing on a year-by-year basis, and new stores are opening and stores are closing. So, you know, the Food Trust really has developed this methodology to do much more ground truthing to assess, you know, whether an area is truly an area of need. And so this is the research that has been put out. We actually published with Kate Parker, who was formerly at Tulane PRC. Like I said, the success of this type of program truly relies on strong grocer applicants and engagement of the grocery industry. Yeah, I work with some folks that have, or some people in the room may have a history with anti-tobacco work, and that was a case in the public health field where you could not partner with the industry, or there was no real point in doing so. And with the grocery industry, you know, while they may not all, you know, come across as the most amazing public health leaders per se, they're, you know, you really need to work with grocers to have some type of success in these types of programs, and they can be engaged as allies and be truly committed to wanting to improve communities and do good by doing well. So that's a key part of the success of any of these initiatives. You don't see grocers lining up, oh, I know there's this new public-private partnership and government program. Please sign me up. That's not quite the way it works. There's, you know, some suspicion around any type of government programming and a lot of outreach and pipeline development that needs to be done in order to really see this kind of success. What I want to do is lift the veil a little bit. I know with any of these types of programs, there are challenges. So I want to open up to what some of those challenges have been in implementing this program. So the first one was some population concerns. You know, certainly the city saw a huge population drop post-Katrina, and there were certain target communities that we were really looking to hit with this program. We knew that there were neighborhoods. We really want to get a grocery store in certain parts of the city that, you know, we knew to be underserved. And there were some hesitance on behalf of the industry saying, I don't think people are back there yet. I don't know if that neighborhood can support a grocery store. And it was definitely a chicken or egg situation. If, you know, are we going to wait till the residents come back, or are we going to build a store so the residents come back? So that's certainly something we saw. Over time, however, you know, we thought, for example, we'll never get an application in the lower ninth ward. That's just not going to happen. People were telling us, good luck, yeah, we'll see that. So, but then over time, we were starting to see grocers do, you know, site tours and look at specific parcels of land and we still do have hopes for a lot of the parts of the city that we're looking to reach. In talking about site selection, a lot of times cities or different institutions may have come up with a list or a specific site. You know, we have a site here that we want you to put a grocery store right here because this is where, you know, there's this complementary development or for whatever reason. And that's not necessarily the way the grocery industry works. So we really try to let grocers guide the process of choosing sites and then determining, okay, well, this site could be eligible for funding, but maybe this other site you're looking at would not be. Because, you know, we want the site to be sustainable within the market, too, and be able to have a market study that shows it will be successful, because there may be an ideal site from a health perspective or a planning perspective, but that's actually not a place where a grocery store can be the most viable. So thinking about new models and startups, we've had a lot of interest. We've gotten over 60 applications to the program and have heard a lot of wonderful ideas about grocery stores, and we're going to build a store that has, you know, 50% produce on the shelves, and you know, it's all going to be local and affordable and, you know, all organic. And, you know, we've heard a lot of different concepts out there, and some of them are workable and some of them can't be. And so we want to be encouraging, you know, entrepreneurs to expand into this world while also recognizing that it needs to be a store that stays in the community long term. So there's no benefit to, you know, streaming a bunch of public dollars into a great idea that then a few years later is going to close. These projects do take a long time. You know, Kelia talked about the analysis they did from 2011 to 2013. Our first stores opened in 2013 and 2014, really. So the time that it takes with, you know, no control by the program managers for grocery stores to get up and running, you know, sometimes there's a lawsuit within the family where one brother is suing the other brother. Some people in New Orleans might have heard about this. Or there may be a landlord that's saying, well, I'm not going to take less than this amount for the property, even though that property, you know, is such a great location in an area that you're trying to get a grocery store into. Or all of a sudden one retailer says, actually, we're no longer considering this market, you know, and we're going to sell this whole chain of stores to another operator. So these things happen and lengthen the process. We're always also looking to prioritize projects based on community expectations, so meeting the expectations of the community while also, you know, being able to have a store that will be interested and financially sustainable. And lastly, there have been tons of misperceptions about the program. I won't list them all here, but people, you know, will think that it's meant for one thing while it may not be. I do want to talk about two projects that we are very proud of. I'll first talk about the Circle Food Store, which you saw in the video. This is the oldest African-American-owned grocery store in New Orleans, and it's been around since the 30s. The owner, Dwayne Boudreaux, was part of our initial food policy advisory committee, and when we launched the program, we thought, gee, wouldn't it be great to reopen Circle Food Store? It's been closed since Katrina. This is exactly the type of project that we'd want to fund through this initiative. It took a lot because to get all the funding together and to do the environmental remediation that was needed to be done. The store during Katrina was under 6 feet of water, so quite a bit of work, and it's a historic site. Quite a bit of work was needed to be done and funds brought in to make that happen. But the video already previewed what the end of the story is, so I don't need to tell you, but it reopened just last year. Pictured on the top is Dwayne Boudreaux, and on the bottom left, the woman holding the green bell peppers. Circle is famous for their 4 for $1 bell pepper sales. And this store is really, you know, a community nexus in the 7th Ward, Treme area, if you're familiar with that. And it's just been, when it opened, it was a huge event, and people were, before the store opened, were walking by every day to ask the owner, when are you going to reopen? And this was years before it happened. Another project is the Refresh Project over in the Mid-City neighborhood. This was an old Schwegman's grocery chain before the storm. And speaking of startup ideas or great concepts, I talked to the executive director, Jeff Schwartz, of a neighborhood organization, Broad Community Connections, in this neighborhood back in 2011. And he said, you know, there's this vacant property on Broad Street. We're thinking as a neighborhood organization, we're going to buy it and get a retailer in there. And I was saying, you know, is this really going to happen? Do you have a retailer lined up? Do you have somebody? Well, we think we might be able to get Whole Foods in there. And I said, really? Who have you spoken to there? And have they put in a letter of intent? And, you know, will they commit to signing a lease? And actually, this site, in addition, actually didn't meet the original food desert criteria when it came out, when the USDA put out its first maps. So that was, you know, another question that they had. But, you know, it was able to come together. They were able to get the commitment not only from Whole Foods as part of a national trend of Whole Foods expanding into some inner city and more mixed income areas, but also to get several other tenants to commit to being in there. So it wasn't going to be just a grocery store, but it was also going to be a medical student training program and a culinary training program and a community garden, and also work in conjunction with a lot of other community revitalization efforts. So this is earlier this year when the Whole Foods opened, and it was actually the site of a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation announcement just the other day as part of APHA. We had hoped to do store tours as part of the food and nutrition component of APHA, but if you do have another day or two in New Orleans, I encourage you to go check out not just the stores where the Refresh Project and Whole and Circle Foods are located, but also the neighborhoods where you can see, you know, when you go through these neighborhoods and you see where residents, where they're walking to, how they're getting there, and how these types of grocery stores or other types of fresh food projects will really change the community long term. I mean, it takes some time. I really look forward to going back to these neighborhoods 2 or 3 years down the line and seeing the other retail that's formed and the other types of things happening in the communities to look into, you know, how these food stores have an effect. So here is my information. If you have any other questions, I know we are running short on time. Thank you. And I can invite the other panelists. I don't know if you guys want to come back up here if people have.
Thanks for the presentation. So one of the tools in the toolbox that you outlined were for giveable loans, mm-hmm. right? And just wondering, sort of a two-part question. Number one, based on your experience in other cities, what percentage of retailers who receive a forgivable loan end up defaulting on that forgivable loan? And then number two, who's on the hook for it? Who realizes that loss? Is it the trust? Is it CFI? Is it the foundation?
So usually, you know, the way it works in Pennsylvania, we also had grant dollars, and we utilized the public dollars to go towards that forgivable or that grant portion. So, you know, that's why, you know, a state allocation or a philanthropic allocation can be more flexible so that, you know, if those dollars don't necessarily need to be recouped in the form of loans. The way it works in New Orleans with our program is that The forgivable loans are technically forgiven over a five-year period. So, well, let's say, you know, the Whole Foods, well, which we hope won't happen, or the Circle Foods closes tomorrow, then that forgivable debt portion will be converted to a traditional loan, and they'll no longer be eligible for that. So that's one of the you know, sort of checkpoints that the city wanted to put in place with their dollars to have it be in the form of forgivable debt as opposed to grants. Right. I mean, we certainly want to see stores that are catering to low-income residents. I mean, where our funding comes from has to be, you know, serving low- to moderate-income populations. So, you know, we want to be putting a grocery store in a community where the residents will actually shop there. So it's certainly something that we consider. It was interesting over the course of talking to several community groups and in the work that the Food Trust does nationally, you know, oftentimes we're hearing, you know, well, we don't want the second-tier grocery store. We see a lot of value chains coming into our neighborhood or dollar stores, and we want the real deal. We want the same type of grocery stores that other community gets. And that's, I think, the case of what, you know, it was one of the concerns definitely we had when looking at the Broad Street project and in talking with Broad Community Connections. But I think overall, that store probably has, you know, for a Whole Foods, one of the higher rates of SNAP redemption. I don't know the data specifically, but, you know, just anecdotally, that it certainly is catering to what the community was looking for. But, it is certainly a challenge trying to meet exactly what the community has in mind in terms of their ideal grocery store, along with a model that's willing to go there and also will be sustainable long-term in the community.
My intention really wasn't to sort of portray the neighborhood as being fragmented as a community. There are active senior groups, for example, that are, you know, definitely quite active. And the problem, I guess, that I was trying to point to was that the Holy Good Market, for example, really try to partner with those active groups to reach out to the entire community. There's a limitation to utilizing those network as a way to really reach the entire community. Again, my point was to really shed light on the people who are left out of that or not connected to those social ties, who are most vulnerable in terms of, again, being notified, you know, noticed as a vulnerable population in the community. And I think also it's possible that those social ties goes beyond the neighborhood. For example, they might have sister in another neighborhood that could just come and give them a ride to go to actually like in Walmart, you know, that's a good 15 miles away, and a lot of them actually shop there from the neighborhood. And so again, you know, it's a food desert, but a lot of them actually were accessing, you know, affordable food, which just happened to be a way. But so I think they do have social support. It's just that it doesn't exist in that sort of a spatially confined definition of a community, I guess, is what I was trying to point to. Thank you.
Sure, yes.
This is another question for Dr.
Stay here then. Yeah, so we did ask the question two months after the completion of the study. This is when we did the follow-up survey, and we asked them, have you been back to the market? You know, if so, have you, you know, how often? Have you talked to your friends or neighbors about it? Half of them have been back. They haven't bought box, but they have been buying things that they like greens, for example, in the wintertime, and some fruit that they really like to purchase from them. And they seem to have also talked to a lot of neighbors, so, you know, maybe that was kind of a beginning of maybe something in terms of them being aware of that. So the other part of the question about, you know, what really was the obstacle, it seemed to us that really people didn't know about it. That was the biggest obstacle in terms of the market's reach. And so, again, they did flyers, and they, you know, put their, you know, advertisement in the neighborhood, the newsletters, and talked to the senior groups. And it just seems that there are people who are not being reached by those outreach. And so once they find out about it, it seems that they have come a little bit. Another thing is that at the beginning, when they were only solely doing the box, residents have come once, they figure out that wasn't for them, and they just didn't come back. And again, so that was, you know, in terms of a timeline, some of the changes that happened at the market just wasn't really communicated effectively to the people in the neighborhood.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming at the last day, the earliest session. And I think that's going to conclude it. And if there's no other questions, let's give a round of applause for all our speakers.